Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds.
Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
This is Captain Jonathan Archer.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Failing frequencies open, sir.
We are back, ladies and gents. Thank you for tuning in. Welcome to another episode of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. My name is Jordan Hoffman. We're here today with Brian. Brian, how are you, sir, today?
Doing good, Jordan.
You're not wearing plaid today.
No, it's we have like a half day here, so I always end up wearing just a t-shirt. Everyone in the office just does that. It's like if you walk around here, you'll see most people are much more casually dressed, and a lot of people wearing just t-shirts.
Just t-shirts. No pants, just t-shirts.
Yes,
well,
no,
we're here
no pants.
On Deck 44 in the Battle Bridge today. We are recording a couple days before the 4th of July break. 4th of July this year is on a Tuesday, which means it's like a 9-day weekend. Like,
yes.
Nobody's working now. Nobody's going to be working for a long
just
time.
Me.
Just you. A lot of things to talk about. We have a great guest today, a colleague of mine, a woman I hold in very high esteem, by the name of Stephanie Zaharik, is coming. Stephanie is the film critic at Time Magazine, and prior to that worked at The Village Voice, and prior to that worked at Salon for a number of years. She is a Pulitzer Prize finalist. So, you know, we've had people that have won some prizes here on this show.
When are we going to win a prize?
We've had a lot of award finalists and winners on the show. Dr. Lawrence Krauss has won a million science awards. We've had Michael Westmore on. He's won an Academy Award, an Oscar.
Yes.
Probably
and Emmys.
And Emmys. We've probably had other winners of important awards on the show. George Takei has been on. He's got to have won something by now.
I hope so.
Won the award in our heart. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
So Stephanie's going to come on, and we're going to talk about The Wrath of Khan. It's the 35th anniversary of Khan this month. We missed the exact anniversary by a couple of weeks, but this is the 35th anniversary.
Close enough.
So Stephanie's going to come on and talk about it. And it's the movie that even non-Star Trek people know and love. And it really is. You know what? At the end of the day, if there's somebody who claims they don't like Star Trek at all, you can plop them down in front of this. They don't need to know anything. You can get it from the first scenes, and you probably will love it because it really, really, really is good. But before we bring her on, let's talk for a moment about some new news in Star Trek. This week there was an announcement about Discovery, which is getting closer. They're shooting right now. And they announced that one of the directors of the show is none other than Jonathan Frakes. He's going to direct an episode. We don't know which one. And this is great because Jonathan Frakes is a great director. He's directed a lot of great TV, including The Librarians is his thing, which is cool. You know, Burn Notice, Castle, Leverage, The Librarian 2, episodes of something called One of the Twilight Zones from 2002, and of course directed First Contact, one of the greatest Star Trek movies of all time, and directed 3 episodes of Voyager, 3 episodes of Deep Space Nine, 8 episodes of TNG. So with it, he brings, I mean, he's a guy in the director's chair that knows Star Trek. You
Absolutely.
Know, the cast and crew are going to feel comfortable in his arms while he is doing his episode. And it's cool just to bring it back to Trek. It's also funny, you know, Frakes is also doing an episode of The Orville.
That's
Seth MacFarlane's homage to Star Trek, which is coming out at around the same time, which I think is great. I can't wait. I was talking about this with a friend the other day. I mean, it's not going to happen now, but there's a possibility. I'm not saying this is in any official capacity. I'm saying I was spitballing with a friend. because there's a lot of Trek people involved behind the scenes of the Orville. It's not just Frakes is directing one episode. Brandon Braga is directing an episode. And Robert Duncan McNeil is directing an episode. And McFarlane is a friend of Star Trek. I mean, he's been, you know, the American Dad, Family Guy, Star Trek.
Absolutely.
Venn diagram is huge. Imagine the possibility 3 years from now of some sort of Orville Star Trek crossover comic book or something like that.
Yeah, that's I never even thought about that. That would be great.
You know, because IDW, who runs the license for Star Trek, is and for other licenses like G.I. Joe and Transformers, are very cool with crossovers. You know, there's been a Trek Doctor Who, Trek
Trek Lantern,
Trek Green Lantern. There was the DC Hanna-Barbera, which is not IDW, but you know, there's a lot of crossovers in comics is a doable thing.
Yes,
and Seth MacFarlane would love it, and the fans would probably love it. I mean, I'm assuming that the Orville is going to be really good and it's going to last. You know, it looks like it cost a zillion dollars, but I think it's going to do well. And I will not allow, not on my watch. I don't think any listeners or any fans out there are in the mindset of Orville versus Discovery. I don't think it's not an either or. It's not an either Orville. It's a both. They're going to be very different. Orville is a comedy, obviously, but it's very Trek. And it looks like the flashback to TNG. The set looks like TNG, a little bit modernized. And
the uniforms.
The uniforms. And Discovery is its own thing, you know. So in terms of its look, and it's looking really cool. That shot of Jason Isaacs as Captain Lorca of the Discovery is a really, really cool image. And now the new news about Frakes directing both. He's the bridge right there, you know? Yeah. Number one doing two. How about that?
Actually, I've been meaning to mention that I've been reading the IDW comic, is it Mirror Shattered? About the Mirrorverse.
The Mirror Universe with TNG. There was the Free Comic Book Weekly. There was a Free Comic Book Day episode, issue zero.
And then there's been two since.
There's been two since, right. And
we were just introduced to Riker. And it was funny because it's... I don't want to give away spoilers really. But I mean, there's a fist fight with Picard and Riker, and it's very entertaining.
Yeah, and Mirror Universe LaForge looks wild.
Yes,
his visor looks dynamite. And you're one issue ahead of me, by the way, because I haven't gotten. It's quite all right.
Hey, I sat through the Beyond review before I saw the movie.
No, you're one ahead. I mean, I have it downloaded. I just haven't gotten around to reading it yet. But that's a really cool. And that's J.K. Woodward does the art for that. And those are all painted panels.
Yeah.
And they look really neat.
They look very much like the actors.
Yeah. He's great. He's terrific. Cool. So that's what's happening. But lastly, before, you know, we're talking about television and comic books and all these great things. If you are a collector in the digital world, Brian, you can't just leave these things on your laptop. You need to save them offline, as it were. And what you need is written here on this piece of paper. What you need is a WD Western Digital hard drive, solid state drive. And WD Western Digital is a sponsor of this show, and we love them. And you know, it's funny. This is no joke. I swear to you, this is true. We've been running these ads for a couple weeks now, and I only just realized that the hard drives I use are Western Digital drives.
There you go.
I swear to you, I haven't gotten any new ones. Western Digital has not given me any freebies since we've been doing this ad, but I have, and I've been enjoying them. And I'll tell you what, and this again is true. I swear to God, I wouldn't be saying it. I got some other hard drives before, and I put my music on there. I had digitized decade and a half of CDs, and I digitized them. I put it on a hard drive, and then I cloned those drives. And the first one I had was not at Western Digital. And I dropped it on a carpet. I didn't drop it on concrete. I dropped it on a cushy, nice carpet. And that hard drive is dead.
Wow.
I had the clone, so it's not a problem.
Okay.
I have since dropped my Western Digital. It still works.
Wow.
There I'm a go. Klutz, by the way. I drop stuff all out, which is why I have clones. I have a couple of WD clones. I even have I have an extra one I need to clone. But, you know, because there's some music out there that you have in digital form that's not on Spotify.
Yeah.
Or if it's on Spotify now, they might take it off.
You can take it off any day.
It's
and
your
yeah.
favorite band. Who's your favorite band, Brian? Limp Bizkit.
No. God, no.
Matchbox 20.
No, I'm actually going to say Megadeth. That's kind of like what I grew up with, really. And it sounds cheesy saying that in this day and age, but
three guitar solos in Hangar 18. What are you talking about? Megadeth, I'm sure, is on Spotify.
You know, I don't know. I have all the albums. I don't really need to look them up on Spotify.
But here's the thing: if you have all the albums, but if you go right now, and if you have Spotify, one day you never know. Dave Mustaine might wake up one morning and decide,
like, you know what? I'm not getting enough money from Spotify.
I don't want it to be on Spotify. They can go
buy my albums.
It can
come
go
camp outside my house and pay a lot of money.
Right. It can go up. He sells, and who's buying? And at some point, can you name this Megadeth song?
Use the Man?
No, this is kind of a random. This is not a...
Mastermind.
There you go.
Okay.
Mastermind from the album Cryptic Writings. My point is this. You need to have it on a drive. So, blah, blah, blah. Western Digital. And just very quickly read to you what it says. Because it's a special deal. Why? Keep your music. Keep your video games. Library. Limited time... You, the listener, engaged listeners, can get 20% off. 20% off select WD solid state drives. There's very specific ones. There's a coupon code, and the coupon code is WDENGAGE, Wood Engage, WD Engage, Wood Engage, and you go to WD.com/engage. And there, you know, it's not everything they sell is 20% off, but there's going to be a couple of choice ones. I think they're 500 gigabyte drives.
The 250 and 500 gig blue and black drives are the ones.
500. That's half a terabyte.
Half a terabyte, yes.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of space.
250 is kind of, I think the ones I have are 250. That's more than enough for me. Mm-hmm. But I don't have any video on there. If you collect shows or video or heavy images with a lot of pixels, man, you might want the 500, and you get 20% off, and they're not too pricey to begin with, so you can get two and get a whole terabyte if you want.
There you go.
So that's at wd.com/engage. That's the good news. So we're going to come back in a moment. Stephanie Zaharik is going to join us. We're going to beam her in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage, the official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
And we're back. We're here on the Battle Bridge here on Deck 44, not on the... main bridge, so I can neither beam her in, nor can I have the special swooping door sound effect. Unless, Brian, can we put that in after the fact?
Of course I can.
All right. Stephanie, would you prefer to be beamed in, or do you want the door that goes whoosh, whoosh?
I want to be beamed in. All right, that's been my dream.
All right, here we go. Wait, I'm cracking my knuckles here. And after the fact... Oh, wait, you're materializing in your seat. A glittery glow... And there she is, ladies and gentlemen. Stephanie Zaharik is here in the studio with us.
How did I get here? It's like magic. Oh, my God.
Suspension of disbelief. And this is an exciting time. We're here to talk about what is, I think, without question, the most respected Star Trek moment, really. The Star Trek film that even people who don't like Star Trek like. The Star Trek film that has had the greatest impact on greater culture. And that is, of course, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which, and Stephanie, you are not particularly a Trekkie or a Trekker. How much of the, what is your knowledge of Star Trek in general? Let's lay our cards down on the table here. What have you watched over the years?
Oh, I actually loved the original show as a kid. And I remember when it was actually on TV at night, whatever night it was, Saturday, and then when it was in syndication.
Yeah.
And what I remember, like, I would come home from school and I would watch, like, Gilligan's Island, which my sisters told me not to watch because they said, that's dumb, it'll rot your brain. Look what happened.
Yes.
And then, I don't know, the Munsters or whatever. There was this
little... Yeah, a block of great syndicated television.
Yeah, and maybe maybe the Newlywed Game was, like, in there. I don't know, whatever. But then Star Trek would come on, and it was a little later. It might have been 6 o'clock, or maybe it was 5. But that was almost dinner time, and there was something in my brain. I was like, this is on later because this is a show for grown-ups. Yes. And I watched it a lot. And I didn't watch it obsessively. Like, I haven't gone back and studied the, you know, every episode.
The canon and the lore of all the minutiae and whatnot. Yeah.
No, but I always loved the characters. And I loved it. And since then, of course, a lot of people have written about the civic idealism of these shows and how obviously it's very multiracial, the casting. And and also this idea of we're going to go out and explore new worlds. And they always find the paradox. They're like, oh wow, this is paradise, but then there's something wrong with it, like the fruit is poison or there's whatever.
Spores, like, there are usually a lot of spores in the plants that ruin things. Yeah.
So I actually really did like the show, but you know, by the time the movie started rolling out, I wasn't really, you know, I sort of lost interest and moved on to other things. So it wasn't like I saw every single one of the movies, but I did see this one. I saw it after the fact. I didn't see it in theaters.
Oh, you didn't see it in theaters at the time?
No.
Okay. And have you ever watched any of the Next Generation stuff, the Patrick Stewart shows and then Deep Space Nine and all that? Have you?
No. Yeah. You know, I know people love them. To me, I just didn't really want to in any way revisit that universe because I really am fond of those original characters. Yeah. So,
you know, I'm going to drop a name here. When I was talking to Sigourney Weaver one time... You like that, Brian? That was good, right?
Of course.
Because, you know, she's sci-fi, she's alien, and somehow...
And Galaxy Quest.
When I was talking to her about Galaxy Quest, I asked her about her stuff of Star Trek, and she didn't really know any of it, not even the original stuff. But she knew a little bit. I said, what about the Next Generation? She said, I've tried to watch it, but every time, it's always about a bunch of shepherds. It's like they're always guys in gray wandering around a mountain herding sheep. And there is like one episode maybe where there's a guy with, but she must have just flipped on and gotten the same one every time. But in her head, she's like, I've tried. It's always shepherds. I just think of shepherds. I have to turn it off. So anyway, I'm not going to argue with her. Far be it from me. So by the time you saw Wrath of Khan, you knew that this was A, kind of the beloved one, and B, you knew that Spock didn't really die, right? At that point? By that one, the third one had come out, and
okay. So, and I was introduced to it by like a film critic, film lover, who said this movie is great. Like, even if you think you really don't, you know, care about the show or the characters that much, which I kind of did.
Sure.
He said, you know, you'll probably love this one, and sure enough, I did.
Yeah. Well, that has happened. This one did. I mean, nowadays Star Trek is more. I think since the rebooted ones that are out right now. And now that geeks control pop culture, it's more kind of okay to say that you love certain Star Trek movies. But I remember Quentin Tarantino really advocating this as one of his favorite movies back in the 90s when he was still considered the voice of underground, cool, you know, legitimate film. And he would say, and he said, "Oh, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan." People were like, "What? That's like a mainstream dopey movie." And then people got to see it that who wouldn't have normally, and agreed. It really is. It's great. And you know, so a little bit of behind the scenes. Then I want to get to your thoughts on it. Part of what makes it great, and I say this as someone who is, you know, that Star Trek is my thing, and I love all of it, and I'm very fond of Gene Roddenberry, the creator, and I sort of do love sort of the deep connections and all the intricacies and reading the tie-in novels and the comic books and all that monstrous stuff. Part of what makes Star Trek II so great is that it was created by people that didn't really care much for Star Trek. All the major players that got this project didn't really know Star Trek. It was like, yeah, this thing, but we have to take it away from the people who have been working on it for 15 years and bring fresh eyes to it. And that's the type of thing that in today's environment would make fans go crazy. Like if they announced tomorrow that the director of Wonder Woman 2 would be someone who had never read a DC comic in his or her life, there would be outrage on the internet, you know? But back then, they didn't have the internet, so there wasn't a problem.
And there was no outrage.
And there was
so
no
nice.
Outrage. It was a nice... 1983. So, you know, what happened was the first Star Trek movie came out, and it was not the success that Paramount had hoped for. They put a lot of money into it, and they made just enough to consider doing a second one. But fans didn't really like it. It was very slow, was very arty, it was very sort of in its own head. It wanted to be 2001: A Space Odyssey, and it was very Gene Roddenberry. And the head of Charles Bloodhorn, the famous Charles Bloodhorn of he owned Gulf and Western, and Paramount was his little side project. You know, he's looking on the ledger sheet and he sees Star Wars is making a ton of money and they've got their Star Trek. And they're like, where's our money? So they brought in a bunch of people to look into making Star Trek. And there was a producer from Paramount Television named Harve Bennett. And somehow he got in the room and they're like, they made the last one for $45 million. What can you do? He's like, I can make five movies for $45 million. He goes, great, you're hired. And he didn't really know much about Star Trek. So he went and he watched all the original episodes, which back then there was, you know, it wasn't VHS tapes. He had to go somewhere and somebody had to, just, you know, put him in a room in Paramount and he had to watch them in a screening room. And he saw the original Space Seed, which has Ricardo Montalban. He's like, aha, that's our villain, because he thought the first one didn't really have a villain. And then they wound up hiring the director, Nicholas Meyer, who was a writer. He'd written the 7% Solution, 10%, the Sherlock Holmes book that was very successful, and he directed Time After Time, which is a fun movie. And he knew even less about Star Trek, but he knew, like, naval movies. And anyway, those are the guys that resuscitated Star Trek and brought it back to life. So we have them to thank for, you know, had it not been for these guys, there would have been no Deep Space Nine and the deep lore and all of the nitty gritty and whatnot. But there are still things in the movie that bug super fans that still have this idealistic utopian vision of what Star Trek ought to be. The fact that the exit signs in the beginning of the movie look like regular exit signs. If you look really close, when they're in like the after the first Kobayashi Maru test, and then Kirk and Spock are in like the hallway, and like there's some kind of like plants that look like futuristic plants. Brian, do you know what I'm talking about? The exit signs?
Yes. They actually look like, in this building here, they have, when there's a fire drill, they have a sign that they put up, and it looks like that. It's like on a stand.
Yeah.
And it's just like a square box, and it looks really out of place.
Yeah, it looks, and it's in the future, you know, which it's not, and it's just like, that drives me crazy. I'll be honest. It doesn't belong there.
See, I was looking at the sparkly curtain. Right. I was like, oh, look, they put a very ingenious production design. They just went to the fabric store and got some sparkly,
Spock's quarters. He's got those beads, like Rhoda Morgenstern. He's got those great beads.
I have so much to say about the movie's production design and and the costume design. It was like, but we can get into that.
Yeah,
a bit
well,
later.
No, well, let, so t- you but actually have some notes with you.
I do because I watched the movie again very carefully.
You watched it again for the first time, in probably many years.
Yeah, I think I wrote a little thing about it in 2000, so I haven't seen it since.
Okay,
then,
it's been a while. So you know, I invite you on the show. You agree to come on, thinking, oh, sure, what the heck, and then you say, oh my God, now I got to do homework. I got to watch Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. What have I gotten myself into? You turn it on, and the first thing you hear is the music.
Yeah.
Brian, let's hear a little bit of the opening theme. Because if nothing else, I think everyone can agree, James Horner's theme to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, it's like a little quasar of light out there in the distance. And a little mechanical beep. And then, I don't know what that sound is. It's ominous, but now it is triumphant. Pretty much every Star Trek has been aping this theme since. It's really one of the great scores. All right. So it's pretty exciting. So, yeah, so tell me, so what was your sort of initial take as you're watching the first 5 minutes? What did you remember and what did you not remember?
Oh, well, what I remembered, this ties into what you were saying about how this is a movie made by people who didn't, you know, particularly care about Star Trek, and they're like, we gotta rip it apart and let's start from the beginning, is that I think that really freed these actors because, you know, in the days since the original show aired, we have gone through many phases of loving and hating, like, you know, some of those actors.
Sure,
like James
sure.
T. Kirk, you know, has become sort of sometimes a laughing stock.
Sure, and, yeah.
But the thing about the performances in this film is they're really moving.
Yeah.
And I think those were always kind of interesting, fun performers. And, you know, on the show, like some episodes, they would have more to do than others, or, you know, one would like spotlight Chekhov or
sure,
whatever.
Sure.
But in this film, like, everybody has their little they're a cool little thing.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly Captain Kirk's relationship with Spock and with Bones in this film, like, those are really his two closest friendships. And they're different. You know, each one is different, but both of them, like, they're the only two people who can kind of stop his wheel spinning.
Right. And
look,
what also is really cool is that when Kirk is alone with Bones, he can kind of, like, because Bones and Spock are at odds, obviously. And when he's with Bones, he's like, yeah, I see it from your point of view. This Spock guy's kind of a pain in the butt. And then he's with Spock. He's like, Bones, he's such a hothead, but we got to deal with him, you know? He can play both sides a little bit, which is what makes it such a great troika, such a great, triangle there. And you're right. Everybody gets their own little moment, which is really nice, because in the previous film, it was just about the special effects and just sort of like the strange look and everything and these sort of heady ideas. With this one, it's really just about people.
Yeah, and that, the ending, obviously, is the,
yeah.
the thing that just really, it really gets you. And, you know, watching it again, where, you see Spock, he's going into the room with the radiation, and he puts on the gloves. I love how he puts on the gloves, like, gloves.
That is funny. He goes in there to sacrifice. He knows he's not coming out alive.
Yeah.
But it's just he has safety ingrained in him, I guess, so he's got to put on gloves. Maybe they're like anti-gravity gloves, because he couldn't pick up the reactor without them, or the flesh on his fingers would have singed off. So, but he just put on gloves to go kill himself, which is nice.
Yeah, it's kind of part of the ritual, you know.
Yeah.
But actually, even as that moment, as that scene progresses, like, you're watching, and you're by today's standards, the special effects, I know people say, primitive, but I think the effects in that movie are actually, I think they're really effective, and I think, obviously he's in the room and he's dying, and that's its own kind of operatic thing. And physically, everything that Leonard Nimoy does in that moment is wonderful. It is this moment where, you know, like, we always have these actors who say, I always really wanted to do Shakespeare, that didn't really pan out.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, you get a movie like this, and people kind of rise to the occasion, And I think this is really an example of that. And of course, William Shatner's response, and the delayed response, like, where he looks in the room and they're stopping him. They're saying, "You don't go in," and he's already dead. And then there's the funeral, which the bagpipes start playing. I'm like, oh, Scotty on the bagpipes. I'm sorry, I have Scottish blood in me. It just always gets me.
It really is. Well, I mean, the thing about that death scene, so many great things about the death scene, but it is, first of all, about the effects. You're right. They're minimal effects. So it's less is more. And Spock up to that point, and even if you've never seen any Star Trek before, this is the first time you've ever encountered these characters, which is kind of impossible in today's pop culture society. But still, by the time this movie, it's already been established that Spock is a selfless figure, and he's he's a sage, he's in that room in his cloak, and he's got his act together. And then after he fixes the warp core matrix, if you must know what it is that he's fixing.
I can never remember
what it is. They never say it, but it's the dilithium chamber of the intermix chamber. But anyway, so when he fixes it, and he's blind, and he bumps into the plexiglass.
Oh my God.
It's such an amazing touch, because it's like seeing somebody who you've always held up as, like, he's going to protect us, he's always got it under control, and you realize, oh my God, he's not. He's fumbling. Mm-hmm. You know, it's seeing somebody in a weak position that you never expect to see weak. And then he bumps into the plexiglass, and he immediately straightens his shirt. Like, he's still got his, you know, I'm going to be professional about this. And Shatner, you know, you're right. Part of his shtick now is Denny Crane and the Priceline Negotiator, and he's a big goofball. And people joke about Shatner and his hair and whatnot and his singing. And we did it just last week on the show. We did a whole episode goofing on his singing.
Oh, you've got to.
But in that scene, find me better film acting. I mean, it's just perfect. I mean, his reaction, he doesn't shout. For the first time in his career, he doesn't shout. He just says no very quietly. He's just destroyed, you know. He's the guy who always figures out a way to save the day, and his best pal has just sacrificed himself. Yeah, and you know, I cry every time. You know, it's even though I know he's going to come back in the next movie.
I know. I mean, I have to say, like when they shoot the coffin out the little, you know, the blue hole. Yes. I'm sure it has a name that is not that.
Yes.
But and then you see it kind of shimmering in the paradise where everything can grow in two minutes. So it's all good. But I'm sorry that I jumped ahead to the ending, you know, and that's big to talk about that big dramatic sequence. But you know, I really think so many things up to that point work so well, even the point where Shatner like bumps into that blonde kid and he's like, I think that's my son.
Right.
You know, and even the look on his face in that discussion that he's having with his
son, he's never
ex.
He said to stay away. What's great about that is that you don't have to be a Star Trek like that son, that woman, the woman, Dr.
Marcus.
Thank you. Yeah. Dr. Carol Marcus. Has never mentioned, you know, in any of the previous episodes. So you really can. Even though this movie is, not only is it part two, it brings back a character from the original show, you don't need to have seen any of it. You just need to know Kirk is the cowboy, and he's finally going to get his, you know, face a challenge, and Ricardo Montalban is the greatest villain in the history of cinema.
Oh my God. He's so sexy.
Well, is
he's
he? Like, no, I mean, I don't know. I mean,
he's sexy.
He's got his hair, his chest, the gloves, the
yeah, that I gotta say that weird costume that like shows off his nipples, and I kept looking at it. I'm like, that can't be his real chest because he was 62 years old.
This is a question that no one knows the real answer to.
But it could be. Maybe they just like really shaved it and waxed it, and
yeah, it's very
just,
waxy.
Like you know, like pumped a lot of iron, like in the days and weeks and hours before. I don't know, but he is very—he's captivating, and that kind of—I mean, it is sort of a mullet, but it's silvery, you know, feathery hair, and he's so angry. There's also obviously the romantic element of he's you know avenging his wife's death.
Sure,
like that's always gonna you know that's always the thing when the man like misses his woman so much that he you know he.
Marla MacGyver's, who was from our time, from the future, but she was a historian. This you would only know from watching the original episode. She was a historian, and she basically turned her back on Starfleet to go be with him. She gave up her life to go live on SETI Alpha 5 and start a new civilization. But of course,
she got killed by the
SETI eel.
Oh, that thing is awful.
It's pretty terrible.
And that's just not, I have to say, like, whatever the special effects are.
Yeah.
That does not get any less terrifying.
No, that scene still works.
Yeah, absolutely.
That scene is terrifying. I say, you know, it gives you a headache every time. But the thing about Montalban's performance as Khan, and tell me if you disagree, I think it's one of the great movie villains, period, but also one of the last movie villains to play it completely straight. I mean, it's a performance that's projected to the cheap seats. Let's no denying it. It's not a subtle performance. And this movie came out in 83, right?
It was 82.
Right. I know a lot about Star Trek. 82. And Die Hard, 87, 86? Around then. I always think of Die Hard as a new day for movie villains. Because Alan Rickman, who's wonderful in Die Hard... The thing that blew everybody's mind away about his performance is that he was funny, and he was, you know, he was against type. He wasn't a typical movie villain. Now it is. I feel that a very high percentage of big Hollywood action adventure movie villains are in that Alan Rickman mold. You know, Philip Seymour Hoffman in Mission Impossible. Every villain Jeremy Irons has been, you know, they're always kind of a little bit, they're not like the tough guy. They're the little crafty kind of sneery guy. And Montalban is not that at all. He's a straight ahead. He's just the physical embodiment of wrath. And he's big and he quotes John Milton. And he will, you know, his best buddy is like, you have everything you need. And he just throws him away. And so his little buddy, Joachim, right? The other blonde guy who's trying to talk sense into him. All Joachim wants Khan to do is to stop chasing Kirk. And he doesn't listen to him. He continues to chase Kirk. And there's a battle, and Joachim dies, and he says to Joachim, "I will avenge you." And he'd be like, "You schmuck, avenge me against yourself. It's all your fault. I told you to leave." You know, but still he won't listen. He's, "I will avenge you." It's like, ah, his dying moment. So
he's not rational.
No. He's a genetic experimentation from the 1990s, and they never are rational. Yeah. So his performance, help me sort of frame Ricardo Montalban as an actor was never particularly respected. I mean, Fantasy Island was a big deal, but I mean, you tell me. I don't know.
And wasn't he the rich Corinthian leather guy? So, yeah. So people knew him from the car
commercials. People knew
him from
car commercials,
right?
Yeah.
You know, but I think, you're right about this particular performance, this particular villain. Like, if you look at the classic model of the Flash Gordon villain,
yeah,
who is like being the merciless, is kind of, you know, obviously there's like a racial issue there, you know, which we won't go into, but it was okay at the time.
Right.
And
well,
not
Khan is
okay
supposed to be Indian also.
Yeah, so I know, like we can't escape it.
Right,
can't go back in time and fix these things. So we just sort of have to address them. But, you know, like being the merciless, there's always this element of camp, you know, that people kind of latch onto. But I think that Khan is interesting because he is excessive. Like you said, like he's playing to the cheap seats. He is big. Even with that silly, like, shrug-type garment that he's wearing and all the necklaces, I don't look at him and think, oh, this is campy. Like, I can't... I have problems with the idea of camp anyway, because I think people too often use it to denote something that they don't want to deal with any real emotion of something. They just want to laugh at it because it's easier.
Sure,
because it's from olden days, so ha-ha. With Khan, I think, obviously, you don't dress like that. There is some element of what we would call camp.
Yeah.
But it really goes beyond that. I think it's more intense. And this guy is just, like, really drilling deep into this idea of, you know, it's like you said, he's not rational. He just, like, keeps going. He's driven by something that is even beyond anything that we can understand. And that fire in him is part of what makes the performance so compelling. It makes him, you know, he's an erotic presence in that film, you know? Even just his relentless pursuit of Kirk, you're like, why? This is important to you for lots of reasons.
He's been thinking about it for a long. Well, that's why he wears that necklace, the medallion of the Delta Shield is like broken from his nemesis is the Federation. He wears that around his neck because it's always going to empower him. I mean, I would imagine Montalban, when he got this role, was like, I am going to just go bananas here, and heaven help me. And but like everything he says is fun to quote, you know. It's just it is very cold in space. Like everything is is just hilarious. And he outdoes Shatner. I mean, that's hard to do. I mean, what's amazing when you think about this movie from a production point of view is that Shatner and Montalban were never on stage together.
Yeah.
They only see each other through screens. I mean, the electricity of the two of them, they don't even need to be in the same room. It's just, it's remarkable. Now, you mentioned the costumes.
Oh.
That the uniforms of were changed for this movie from previous existing Star Trek, the kind of the velour, very
stretchy,
big colors, stretchy
one size
colors
fits most.
Right. And then in the first movie, they had the weird kind of unitards with the belt buckle, and then Nick Meyer like threw that all away and said, "No, we're going with these sort of red, more naval looking things with the snaps on the chest that flap open."
Yeah, Duran kind of.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, you're right. It's a little bit 80s, but a little bit not. So maybe this can lead into if you wanted to talk a little bit about the design, decor, and costumes of the film. What really resonated with you watching it again this week?
Oh God. Well, I have to say one of my favorite sequences is at the beginning when Bones goes to see Kirk and knows Kirk's a little bummed out because it's his birthday and it's not even I guess it's like a midlife crisis, but he really is almost even past. I don't know how old he's supposed to be.
Right, point, right.
But
it's a midlife crisis in the 23rd century.
Yeah. And Bones shows up, and first of all, that apartment is, it's like something out of a Matt Helm movie. He's got like the little space knick-knack shelf.
Yeah, it's hard to know what's going out. You really want to look through the window. He's somewhere in San Francisco, because that's where Starfleet is. Yeah. Now, you don't know if this is like a place that they put him up, if he's part of, you kind of just assume that it's part of like some big complex. Like, he just gets in one elevator and he's at his office, right? That's sort of the vibe you get. It's very futuristic. There's tubes connecting things, but you don't really know. And he's got like old sextants and old kind of naval stuff on one wall. And he's got these two kind of weird looking chairs facing a fireplace that you can't really see. And that's kind of it. That's all you see about it, you know?
He's a space bachelor, dude.
Yeah, he's a space bachelor. Like, you think about who's hanging out at this place. And I imagine you're getting to Bones' pants. Is that where this is leading? Because these are some crazy-looking pants.
My mind. Yeah. They're like chaps, kind of, attached to pants.
Yeah.
The one comment I would say about this movie, though, compared to the first one, is that when you see them in their like street clothes or whatever you want to call it in the first movie, it like screams 70s.
Yeah.
I don't feel like this like applied to the particular time it was filmed.
Yeah. This just screams like... They were going for something, and God knows what it was, but it's cool, you know.
Yeah,
it's,
you're right. It is sort of out of time, and
Bones has a little bit of a Western thing, you know, which maybe was DeForest Kelly. I mean, he got his start doing Westerns. Maybe that was a hats off to him. Who knows? But yeah, when he comes into the apartment, beware Romulans bearing gifts. He's brought him some Romulan ale, and he like kind of takes off his overcoat.
Isn't this illegal?
Right? Yeah, he takes off his overcoat. And he's wearing, like, you're like, what? You're just like, someone hit pause. I need to see what he's wearing here. It's pretty wild. So, yeah. And that's right at the beginning of the movie. And then it just gets better from there. So,
and even, you know, he sits down in a chair and he puts his feet up. And I really obsessed with, he's got some kind of shiny, like, patent leather boots. Or you really just get a glimpse of them. Mm. But they're like, they're taupe. They're like, they're not like camel boots, and they're not brown.
Yeah.
They're like, and I'm just like, this guy really planned out this outfit to come over, you know, for the little birthday celebration. But I love that. And he's got a little scarf, like a little ascot tied in his neck.
Yeah, no, he always had ascots. Yeah. He's a southern gentleman. You know, he is a southern gentleman, and, you know,
so
it's pretty wild. And then, the other kind of street clothes, you don't see... Then everything else, at least from our guys, is predominantly uniforms. But you do see Christy Alley in the turbo lift kind of off hours. And she's wearing like a... I don't know what that is.
Oh.
Like a pirate's blouse or something. It's very billowy.
Very flowy,
Yeah, it looks like a spa bathrobe or something, which makes that whole scene more intimate. Like she's on her way to the... to get a massage or something, and runs into it. It's like being in one of the luxury hotels. Right. On your way to the pool.
Right, exactly. And somebody else in a business suit. I know.
Although I saw Harvey Keitel in a bathrobe in an elevator.
That's nice. That's what. Where are you headed?
Hello. How are you?
And that's really neat. She's got her hair down.
Oh, yeah.
But it's still regulation.
It's still regulation.
Yeah. That's a great character. Now, there's a little bit of what ended up on screen doesn't quite make sense, because she's playing Vulcan, and you're like, why doesn't she behave more like Spock? And then if you go back and read the tie-in books and all the stuff, the lore of the character, originally she was going to be half Vulcan, half Romulan, and then she was raised outside of Vulcan. That's why she behaves a little different. But in the movie, it just goes by so fast you don't even think about it. You know, it's just, she's just a great character. I mean, really, one of the first things she ever did, too. I mean, she's really great, I think, in that, you know, because she's, you know, kind of an eager young cadet, but also seems wise. And she holds her own in that scene with Kirk. You know, there is a lot of sparks between the two of them in the elevator there.
Yeah, and that moment where she leaves the room because Kirk and Carol are going to have their little talk about their son.
Yeah.
And there's this momentary triangle where I forget exactly what Kirk says to her, some like cryptic line of dialogue. She kind of reads it and she's like, okay, I guess I better leave, you know. But it's really interesting.
Yeah, well, if you want to follow the lore, that character Savick, Kirstie Alley never played her, but they got another actress to play her in the follow-ups. And it is implied that she and Spock later had an encounter. And in fact, in some of the books, which are not necessarily considered canon, she and Spock have a child.
Oh,
but it's in, you know, parallel dimensions and all this. It's all it's.
Oh,
it's,
see, it's always a parallel dimension.
Yeah, I know, like, I know. Yeah. That's life. That's
there's too many choices. If you can have a parallel dimension and you don't limit your choices, and too much can happen, yeah. and it just gets not fun for it's, a while for me. Yeah. But anyway, don't listen to what I say.
Not forever. Not that.
Well, Star Trek has one of the most fun parallel dimensions in fiction. I mean,
the mirror universe.
Exactly. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the mirror universe? Do you know about Spock's beard? Does that phrase Spock's beard mean anything?
No, I think I would probably hear that and like run a mile in the other direction. But you know, if it's it's cool.
There is something called the mirror universe, and you could probably figure it out from kind. It's opposite land, bizarro world, where up is down and black is white, and in the mirror universe, our heroes of the USS Enterprise are actually flying the ship, the ISS Enterprise, which is the Imperial starship, and they're evil.
Oh.
And Spock is even evil, and you know how you know he's evil? He's got a beard.
Oh my God.
Spock has a beard. And the idea of your evil twin with a goatee, that comes from the mirror universe. And this is sort of a joke that's been like, you know, your evil twin has it's you but with a goatee. It comes from Spock.
Oh no. Now okay, now I know. Was this a book or
no, this was in the original series. There was an episode called Mirror Mirror. And
oh,
in it, they
okay.
So there was an ion storm over the planet, the Hulkins planet, and they zap into another dimension, and they go to the mirror universe. And our Kirk, the good Kirk, is with Uhura and probably Scotty, I think. And
I think it's four of them.
Yeah, it's Uhura, Scotty, and I forget who else, but it's not Spock. So he gets to the transporter room, and he's like, "Oof, that was a rough transport." Oof, and he looks up to where Spock ought to be, and then it zooms in, and it's Spock doing some sort of like fascist salute, and he's got a, you know, gummed on goatee.
Oh, it's kind of coming back to me now.
That was a big deal.
But I probably saw it. Was like eight.
You were a young lass, and you should have been doing your homework anyhow.
Yeah, well, I know. Come but on. After I was in the Gilligan's Island stupor.
Right. So. Yeah, you had just seen the professor and Marianne and Ginger. I would imagine more of a Ginger than a Marianne as a role model.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Anyway.
I think, you know, Skipper was a big deal for me. You know, I was always very fond of Skipper.
Skipper was awesome.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah, I like Gilligan's Island when I grew up, too.
Who would have been your role model? I'm trying to think.
I don't know,
I guess
actually.
The professor. Maybe. There you are behind the keys making the sound effects go. Can you produce the show with two coconuts? That's the question.
Let's try next time. We'll see how it works.
All right, so Wrath of Khan. So, yes, and you said you wanted to talk a little bit about other design elements that really...
Oh, yeah. Well, also the special effects, because, you know, I really don't understand how... Obviously, a young person who's used to movies today might look at this film and say, gee, the special effects are really primitive. But, I saw Spider-Man Homecoming the other day, and it's like... Oh, wow, look at the way Spider-Man scales that wall. And it's really cool, but I can't say, you know, that looks exactly like the last time I saw Spider-Man scale a wall in Queens.
Right.
We don't have any, like, realistic things to compare these things to anyway.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the thing about special effects, the thinking about this now is this summer the new Mummy came out, which was not a good movie, I thought. Did you see it? Or did you sneak away?
I was not. Well, I wasn't actually on vacation that week, but I took a vacation from the Mummy.
Okay,
so it that
you,
way.
You didn't see it. Fair enough. Well, one of the big stories about the production of the Mummy is that for one sequence, they actually did shoot it in zero gravity. They got one of these planes that can go into high orbit or whatever they can do, and they shot a scene of Tom Cruise zipping around in a plane, floating in the movie, and he and the woman whose name escapes me right now, the blonde, not Teresa Palmer, she's the new Teresa Palmer. They're floating around. Anyway, because I can sometimes be an ostrich, I didn't know any of this before I saw the movie. I watched the movie and I watched the zero G scene. I'm like, these characters bore me and I'm already out of the film, so I wasn't really too impressed. Didn't think anything of it. It didn't strike me as any real exciting special effects moment or, you know, great stunts. After the fact, I learned that they spent $1 zillion renting a plane and gun. I'm like, you know what? It meant nothing. It added nothing to the film that was a quote unquote practical thing versus anything I would have seen otherwise. It didn't really connect. So I guess the point I'm making is, you know, there's an argument about practical effects versus special effects. It kind of doesn't matter unless other things are working also. You know, some of the Spider-Man, if you watch some of the earlier Spider-Man movies, the scenes of him swinging, they do look a little video gamey. And the original Mummy, the Brendan Fraser one, which I really like. I think it's really good.
Yeah, me too.
Some of the
I miss Brendan Fraser. Yeah,
some of the sequences in that really look like they were made on a cheap computer. You know, the flashbacks to ancient Egypt with, you know, throngs of the D.W. Griffith shots that are done on a computer look terrible because it was made in 1999. But it doesn't matter. You know, once you get into it, this is my philosophy on special effects anyway. I don't know if you agree or disagree, but with this... in Wrath of Khan, I mean, some of the images are really quite beautiful. All the scenes of the Mutara Nebula at the end, the purple and blue. It's all it is purple and blue clouds. And then when they're in the Genesis planet, it's clearly a matte painting, but it looks nice. And that's really... And then the photons and the phasers. There aren't too many special effects in the movie, I guess.
No, well, and even just the shot, you know, shots of the ship in space, which is so, you know, this like bright, like nightlight and this like inky, and it's so beautiful. And it ties back to, you know, Kirk always had that traditional Siemens thing of like referring to the ship as a beautiful lady,
right.
You know, and you see the ship just the way it looks, and it's a complete. I don't know how they do that. They just like dangle the model and put in a black and light it a certain way, and it just looks beautiful.
Yeah, you know,
it's very simple, but it actually there's an emotional tie. Like when I see the ship made to look that way, I'm like, I really love the ship and everybody on it. Like it's
like all your pals live there. Yeah.
Yeah. Emotional connection. So,
well, there's that great moment at the beginning when Spock says, when they're in that room with the exit sign, he says, where are you going? Spock is like, I have to go to the Enterprise before your inspection. Where are you going? And he says, home. But really, the Enterprise is his home, right? Yeah. And that apartment, that swinging bachelor pad with the weird stuff on the wall, that's not his home. It's the ship. So that is the implication. I mean, it really is. I mean, the thing about the Enterprise is it's a, even back from the 60s, it was a totally new type of idea for a ship. I mean, rockets were rockets and UFOs were Dixie plates or whatever upside down. This is sort of a hybrid of the two, and it worked and it's stuck, you know. And then the new ship you see in this, the Reliant, it's kind of the Enterprise upside down.
Yeah,
you know, that's sort of, it kind of looks like the Enterprise but a little different, you know, and
somehow not as good, you know.
Of course not
inferior no. ship, but you know,
absolutely not. Yeah, absolutely not. And apparently they could run it with just like six guys because they take the entire crew, stick them on the planet. Doesn't quite make sense. But that's okay. There's another thing that doesn't really make sense. If you really know the show, when Khan, when he's got the captain Tyrell and Chekhov on the Botany Bay on the planet, and he says to Tyrell, goes, "You, I don't know," right? And then he says to Chekhov, "But you, I know. I never forget a face." Yeah, technically, the character of Chekhov was not on the show in the season that the episode Space Seed is in. So they actually did never meet on the show.
Oh.
Right, but you don't really need to know that.
He heard the story.
He heard the story. Or, you know what?
Somebody said, watch out for that guy.
the fan theory is that they did meet, because he says, I never forget a face. They did meet, just that the camera wasn't on them at the time. You know, we were cut to commercial, and then they met Chekhov, you know? So that's the thinking on that one. But I love that scene when he's got them lined up, and he's just like, you know, he's like been waiting for so long for somebody to come visit him, and he's finally going to just milk it for everything they've got.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
Do you think the ending, I mean, the ending of the death scene, obviously, is very, very, very powerful, very moving, and it really does work. And then they try to spin it with, like, you know, death and life, death and birth, the new planet is born, and they're gazing at the planet, and he says he feels young again. Does that ending work for you, or is it a little hokey, or?
Oh, it totally works.
Yeah?
In fact, it works for me, again, like, I haven't looked at this movie in 17 years.
Yeah.
It works for me at the age I am now, and yeah. I know a lot of older dudes who probably should have a look at this movie, because it really, it is kind of poetic. I mean, you can say, oh, you know, it's clunky, or this is just like a stereotype of how an older person might feel.
Yeah.
But I think it really strikes at some core idea of you reach a certain age, maybe especially for men, but I think it happens for women too. And you really do have to, you have to reinvent yourself sometimes by going back to the thing that you're best at and realizing mm-hmm. like you're not done with that, and you have to like dig in a little deeper, and sometimes you have to go, you know, do something else completely different. But I think what Kirk learns is, you know, he does, he belongs on the ship, that like that's his
yeah.
But also this idea of, you know, he has that line about that this is the first time he ever faced death. Like
right,
he was always
right.
used to cheating it, you know, and then he loses a friend and it's like, whoa.
Basically, he's been one of these guys who always gets by on his good looks and his luck, and that everybody loves him, and he's always run around the rules, and he finally finds a wall that he can't climb over, you know, or he can't escape this, and he can't rely on his old tricks anymore, and he's got to learn how to adapt to a different lifestyle. You know, he's played his hand one too many times, and for a while looks like he's not going to come up from it, but then he does. So in a way, it's kind of ruined by the third movie because he gets Spock back. Maybe yeah. That's not a good message.
Well, I've never seen the third. I think I you know, again.
Yeah. Have you seen the fourth one when they go to the 80s and when they go to now, which was 1986 or 7 when it came out, when they go to San Francisco? They have to go back in time. It was whales.
Yes.
Do you remember the one with whales?
I did see the one with the whales. Yeah.
Yeah. And that one is fantastic. It's so much fun.
Yeah.
It's the funniest of them all, of all of them. You know, it's the funniest anything in Star Trek from any of its 700 episodes.
And this idea of just someone just going for broke and saying, well, let's just, you know, let's just do this crazy thing.
Yeah.
It, you know, it almost always, even if it doesn't work at the time, sometimes in retrospect, it turns out to be
Well, it's
brilliant.
A great fish out of water story because it's a thing where you can, as an audience member, you totally understand both sides because you know and love these characters. You know what their world is, but now they're in our world. They're on our turf, which is modern. Now it's a little dated because it was 30 years ago, but it's great to watch them interact with our world. It's like bringing a great friend, maybe who lives a great friend that you know that lives overseas. You know, your friend from Germany is coming, and you're taking them there. Oh, come visit my parents. You know, we're gonna come to my hometown, and you're gonna see the weird way I grew up. And that's kind of what watching that movie is. It's really it's very fun. But so that's why he came back, because they needed to have that one. So, you know,
he couldn't really die. I know.
Yeah, no, it's too much. What were some of the other very key points that I wanted to make about this? I think I said. Were there some other key points that you wanted to make about Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, the greatest motion picture ever made?
It's pretty damn good. I don't know. I even like things like the fact that Paul Winfield, you know, shows up as Terrell. And he was an amazing actor. And, you know, that's something else that we don't really talk about is, you know, that movies at that time and, you know, a movie like this would make room for an actor of color, which is good. You could wish that his role was bigger. But like, you know, at least he got in there and he was great in Sounder. Like, that's a movie that sort of has, you know, disappeared from the landscape. I don't know, it's terrific. But so I love seeing actors like that just kind of
He shows
show
up again in Next Generation. He has one of the best episodes in all of with opposite Patrick Stewart.
Oh, good.
In an episode called Darmok, which is actually based on the Epic of Gilgamesh, just set on a abandoned planet somewhere. He's great. And Dr. Carol Marcus, she's kind of a tough cookie. I like her a lot, too.
Yeah, me too.
The actress's name is Bibi Besh, I want to say.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And she, what's interesting about her, and this is another example of this producer and these writers and directors taking something that wouldn't have existed previously in Star Trek, which is there's that antagonism between civilian and Starfleet. And she and her team of scientists were like, no. The Reliant works for us. And this is not a government property and what the hell is going on. And there's a little bit of a distrust there. That is a very specific example of something that Gene Roddenberry would never have allowed, because in his view, everything, total Marxist utopia, everything's one. There is no government, there is no people, it's all just one happy family. And a lot of what's great about Star Trek stems from that vision. I mean, so much of what makes it work. But when you do add a little bit of antagonism, it makes it so much more fun. So that's why there's sort of this balance between the two. I mean, Roddenberry would have just struck that whole aspect out of the show, of this movie, which he had almost no involvement in. He gets the title of creative consultant, which was, he was kicked upstairs, basically. They gave him a bunch of money and said, go away, and there was nothing he could do. And so I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it. But I think that aspect of it does make it pretty interesting.
And also the dynamic with the son. The kid is kind of the hippie, and he's like, you know, don't trust these people, Mom.
Right, right.
And she's like, well.
One of them's kind of all right, actually. Yeah. I have a bit of fondness for one of them, and we'll get into why later. So,
yeah
it ultimately does work out. What do you think about the character of Spock, about Leonard Nimoy particular? I mean, this is a guy who, in kind of nerd culture, if there's a nerd Mount Rushmore, there's nothing more prominent than his pointy ears carved in stone. And I mean, maybe Gandalf. I mean, who from nerd? I guess Darth Vader. I mean, who from Star Wars? Han Solo, I guess. I don't know. So it gets kind of murky with, but Spock is kind of the guy. If you have to pick one guy for nerds, right? And nowadays, nerds are cool, allegedly. But but for years, it wasn't the case. And if there was one guy, I'd be like, that guy's into Spock, you know, Yoda Spock, you know. Does the guy get on your nerves a little bit? Is he too perfect? Is he too logical?
No, he has never gotten on my nerves. And even, what you know, first of all, he's so tall. Like, what a beautiful actor, you know, that this tall figure, and even with, like, the pants tucked into the little boots. How they make that work, I don't know. Because sometimes you see that look in real life, and you're like, I don't know. But
he pulled it off.
It works. You know, it maybe with those long legs, I don't know. But the thing about him is, if you're a woman or a gay man who has ever dated a guy who does not feel at all comfortable talking about his feelings,
yes,
then you sort of know. Like, you learn to watch for certain signals. And I think the great thing about Spock as a character is he really teaches you to look for those signals, because he drops them, as we know, he drops them a lot. There's always this one where he says, this is not logical. But then you see there's just like that little flicker of, you know, the human you know, side coming out. And so you're like, I just saw it. You know, now I have something to work with.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's like the only reason I've always loved that character, but it just,
that's something that resonated with you. Well, you know, it's funny because Vulcans and Spock, you know, the official story is, you know, humor, you know, what is this humor that you humans do? The guy's hysterical. I mean, on the original show also, he's always like, you never quite know it's a joke the first time, or when you're a kid anyhow, but you're watching, it's like, oh, this guy's zinging him right now, and you don't really realize it. He's always making jokes. And, you know, in Star Trek lore, it's because he's half human or whatever. But even the later Vulcans, Tuvok is all human. But he, too, likes to zing Catherine Janeway a little bit now and then. There's a lot of shticky humor. Not so much in Wrath of Khan. I'm trying to think. Maybe a little bit here and there. It's all in the eyebrow raises and kind of the glances and whatnot. What? There's a lot of, like, a little bit of Borscht Belt humor going on between him and Kirk.
Well, and at the beginning, where Spock has given him the book, A Tale of Two Cities, and, you know, he quotes the line from it and says, oh, are you trying to give me a message? And Spock says, only if you want to read it that way. Something like that. It's just kind of course, we know that there is a message being imparted by Spock giving him this book. But, he's a little like,
Vulcans are passive aggressive? Is that what we've discovered here? My God.
A little. Well, like I said, if you've ever dated a guy, whatever.
That's a good point. You know, there's a lot of quoting of of big books. Milton, Dickens, a lot of Moby Dick. I mean, it's if you're going to go big, yeah, go big or go home, right? This is a big movie. Khan is going to is gonna quote Moby Dick as he's dying and bleeding out of his head. So, you know, what else are you going to do? What else are you going to do? Well, listen, I think we're just about out of time. I mean, we could just talk about the great scenes from Wrath of Khan all day long, but I don't want to keep you here on Deck 44 too long, but I do want to thank you for coming in. If you have any final thoughts you want to get to, anything specific that... what didn't you like about this movie? You can't just have loved everything.
Well, I pretty much love everything.
Wow, okay.
I mean, I love that it works. It works on its own. I mean, it really, you really don't need to know anything about it. And I think that's one thing that people who really, really love the show and have watched all of the subsequent, you know, series and the, you know, the one disadvantage that you have if you're that, like, ingrained in the whole universe is that you can't see how beautifully it works just as a one-off.
Right, right. That's a really good point because I watched it again this week. For me, it was the 800th time, but I watched again and was thinking about it from a what if you didn't know anything? Would it still work? And it absolutely would. I mean, and nobody on the planet is going to not know. So you're going to know Kirk is the cowboy and Spock is the... wise and you know, wise guy and it really is its own thing. The title is in a way misleading. It doesn't have to be part two, which is rare because I do think later Star Trek films, you know, if you just come in, just parachute in, it's gonna be like this. Not that you can't follow it. I mean, all these Marvel films, you could follow any of them, but it may not have the same resonance. And usually if there's something you don't get, it's because it's a joke because you don't know that character. Like if you, the new Spider-Man, which is out any day now, and this is not too big of a spoiler, but Captain America shows up in it and does something funny for a minute. And if you haven't seen the Captain America movies, it's not, you're not going to laugh, but it's also 10 seconds, 15 seconds, you know, it doesn't really matter to the story. So I think most of these connected things. It's different from TV where it's, if it's season 3, episode 6 and you go, oh, let's turn this on now, you can't. The TV landscape, I think, now is really, I don't want to say difficult because working in a uranium mine is difficult. You know, watching television is not difficult. But, I mean, there are these shows that you hear about that you would love to watch. You know, I would love to watch whatever, The Americans, I hear, is very good. You can't just turn it on one day. You got to go back and watch the first 4 years, you know?
Yeah. And the one thing that The Wrath of Khan does really well, I think, is it gets you up to speed on caring about those characters pretty quickly, even if you don't know. I mean, again, I knew them and I had fondness for them, so maybe I can't even accurately say that. But if I were to really look at how those early scenes are dramatized, I would say it's laid out pretty clearly.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, like you were saying, where the loyalties are and what, and obviously Kirk's crisis of, you know, I'm getting old, what am I doing? You know, all of that, like, resonates. And it's actually very carefully put together so that it works emotionally, I think.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and the of the new reboots, of which I'm by and large very fond of, I think the first one works very well. I love the third one, the most recent one. And then the one in the middle tries to mirror Wrath of Khan to an extent. The last time I watched Star Trek Into Darkness, because at first I didn't really like it. Then I watched it again recently, last summer when the new one came out. They did a screening of all three together at the IMAX. And I kind of came to terms with it again. I said, I like Star Trek Into Darkness. It's fine. You know, it's propulsive. It's energetic. It looks cool. There's a lot of the jokes land. You know, I'm over the fact that the central conflict doesn't make any sense and it's stupid that they brought Khan back or whatever. I'm like, it's fine. I like it again. When I watch Wrath of Khan again this week, man, I hate Star Trek Into Darkness now. Like, why did they bother? Why did they bother trying to ape that? What a dumb idea. I'm not supposed to say that on the Star Trek podcast, but that movie, Star Trek Into Darkness, is the best possible movie you could make out of a really dumb idea. It's not totally worthless. It's still part of our thing. It's part of the canon, and we there are many, many things in it to like. You like how I'm backpedaling right now? There are a lot of great things in there to like, but ultimately they should have gone a different way. And when you watch Wrath of Khan again, it does make you, much like Kirk in the Genesis Planet, it makes you want to raise your fist and shout a little bit. So anyway, you agree, Brian?
Yes, I do. I was going to say before, you were talking about it standing as a standalone film.
Yeah.
And you know, you're not really needing to see the original episode. I mean,
Space Seed. Yeah.
But I think it skirts a fine line, because there are certain little details there that kind of add to it a little bit. Like, you know, when Chekhov sees the belt on the wall.
It says Botany Bay.
And, like, I think that adds a little weight to it.
Yeah.
And also, when he's talking about his wife, like, I actually had forgotten that his wife,
Marlon MacIvers, yeah,
was from Starfleet. Like, yeah. You reminded me of that while we're recording here. I think that definitely adds some emotional weight to Khan.
Yeah.
And his you know, desire for revenge.
Oh, it's definitely extra flavoring that only adds to it. But what's great about the movie is it's not, like we're saying, it's not a requirement.
It's not.
Know?
Yeah, absolutely not.
And I think that's what some of these, you know, eventually there, I don't know, maybe I'd have to really do a frame and a look at each one of the Marvel films. I think they're doing that too. Like, you don't really need to know. Like, can you just jump into Civil War? Maybe you can't. I don't know. Can you enjoy Captain America Civil War if you've never seen any of the other ones? Probably not.
That's hard, because I've seen all of them as they come out. I haven't seen one out of sequence, really. So
I don't know.
I've seen all of them, but I'm kind of an amnesiac when it comes
to that. Right,
you forget. Forget. What happened in the last one? Oh, yeah, at the end, they all got together and they fought a big machine thing with rays coming out of his eyes. And then I'm like, okay, so what are we going to do now?
Well, you know, it's funny. I went and saw the new Planet of the Apes, the third one, the third of the new ones. And as I'm sitting down, I realized that I remember liking the second one, but I didn't remember a damn thing. And I turned to our colleague, and she's been a guest on the show, Allison Wilmore, who you know very well. I said to her, wait, I remember I liked the second one, but what the hell happened? And she's like, apes and man fought, I think, I don't know. And then the movie starts, and you realize, you know, it's not like, you know, there are some things that you really like. You know, Game of Thrones is one of the new shows that I do kind of watch. And that one, you really do need to have your chart out there. Otherwise, you're lost. Yeah. I mean, you need that family tree. But for some of these, they know what they're doing. You know, that's a general rule. You really don't need to know everything. So I don't know. Have you seen Game of Thrones at all? Yeah.
No,
it's a big, tall ask. It's an investment of time. I'm behind on it.
But I realized, I have to start watching from the beginning.
That one you would. And we've gone off topic, but that sometimes happens on the show. My wife just will say, who is this bearded guy again? And I go, oh, this is, and then you hit pause and you go to Wikipedia. And that's kind of no way to watch a television show. But for that one, I make the exception, because it is, the rewards are there, but it is like, it's a little bit of schoolwork, you know?
Yeah, I mean, especially if you read those books, too. Like,
oh, hell no. I'm never reading. There's 1,000 pages. I got to not, you know.
One of those books is bigger than the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But I've read them and reread them, so like you see like some of the plotting like they did, and like how far back they go is ridiculous.
Oh, I'm sure that those books are marvelous, but I've never actually finished a Brothers Karamazov, so if I'm going to read a 1,000-page book of rich lore and stuff, you know, I'm going to do that one first, you know? You give me a look like, what the hell? You got to read Brothers Karamazov. What's wrong with you?
No, I haven't read it either. I'm thinking the same thing. I'm like,
I started that one twice. I liked it, but it's thick and long, and I'd like to consider myself a bright guy. I'm sure I could finish it, but so that's what I, because there have been times that I'm like, oh, maybe I should read the Game of Thrones books. I like the show. Everybody likes it. I'm like, oh God, give me a break. It's ridiculous. And I have to read my Star Trek tie-in novels also, of which I'm behind.
A lot of those.
Oh my God, they pump out one a month for 30 years. And now they're going to start doing ones for Discovery too.
That's true. Well, we know David Mack.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, you know. All right. Well, thanks for joining the Game of Thrones podcast. Yes, you have
one last question. I feel like we can't talk about The Wrath of Khan without talking about one of his most famous scenes.
Oh, The Scream.
The Scream. So, your thoughts, is it a perfect example of dramatic expression, or is it over the top? The Khan scream.
Shatner in the
yeah. I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
I'm fine with it. You know, it's funny. That doesn't strike me as like, you know, strange or it's operatic.
It became coded as overacting after the fact. I think at the time it was fine, and then later it became the ground zero of Shatner, the overactor, and it was parodied on Seinfeld, right? And I think it was the Seinfeld parody that it became a thing. And now they're like T-shirts of him shouting Khan and whatnot. But and we can close on this. So the big moment, the big Khan, which now at the Star Trek conventions, they're actually have been, and I've actually conducted these experiments where people will come up and try to do their best Khan. Like the fans will come up and scream Khan, and then say, who thinks it's the guy in the red shirt? Who thinks it's this woman here? So, but if you think about the moment in the film, if you've seen the movie 100 times, you know that in that sequence, when Kirk is down on the planet and Khan's listening in, and he knows he's listening in, which is why he and Spock have been speaking in code. Hours will seem like days, right? So he knows that people are listening in. So this is what I once asked Nicholas Meyer in an interview in February of 2012. Lo, those many years ago. Quote, I'm quoting myself. When you see the movie for the first time, you believe that Kirk really thinks he is trapped. When you see it the second time, you realize that he knows he has worked out a plan with Spock back on the Enterprise and they are working on a way to rescue him. Therefore, he has to perform, as it were, for Khan. He has to convince Khan that Khan has truly bested him, so he will leave, so Spock can then come back and save the day. Therefore, the somewhat, quote, over-the-top line reading that has become legendary is actually quite savvy, because Kirk has to get Khan to think, yes, I've won. Did that level of thinking go into the line reading, I asked Nicholas Meyer, or am I just babbling incoherently to you? To which Nicholas Meyer said, you are babbling incoherently to me. So there you go. And with that, I want to thank Stephanie for coming on the show today. This was a blast. You can read Stephanie's work in Time Magazine week to week, where she reviews the current cinema and writes about, occasionally interviews directors and actors, and just had a great interview with Sofia Coppola a few weeks ago. And and in all honesty, now I'm gonna kiss Stephanie's rear end a little bit. The truth of the matter is, I never read any other reviews of movies until I've written my own, obviously. And I write a movie review, and then everybody goes up on the same day. And then when it's up, and I go, okay, people have written their review, the first one I check is yours. Because I want to go, for a number of reasons. One, I enjoy your writing, obviously. And two, I have to say, I like this, or I didn't like this. I have to make sure that Stephanie feels the same way. And when we disagree, which is rarely, but it happens once in a blue moon, I then have to take a little walk around the block and go, what did I don't want to say get wrong or get right. I want to say, it's not never that. It's like, there's something in it that connected differently, and I'm curious about it, and I want to learn from it a little bit. You know, it's never a right or wrong thing, but it's like, because usually you're right all the time, and we agree, which also means that we're crazy because we frequently disagree with everybody else. Yeah. Let's get that right out of the way. There's few critics out there that gets more hate mail than you, which means by extension I'm also wrong. But occasionally we do disagree, and it's always fascinating to me how we disagree with something. So you know,
that's the loveliest compliment anyone has ever given me. Tut-tut. Seriously, yeah. I know.
Well, it's true. So we can read your work in Time Magazine every week. One can follow you on Twitter and send you hate tweets at your first initial last name,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's at S as a Herrick. So.
And the spelling of that last name is?
Z as in zebra, A, C as in cat, H-A-R-E-K.
Awesome. Cool. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on the show, and we will see you all next week with a new episode.
Chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor. Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.